There were three of them, three girls. They were standing side by side. They were standing at attention. And then the girl in the pink dress, the one who was standing right next to Raimi, let out a sob and said, "The more I think about it, the more terrified I am. I am too terrified to go on." The girl clutched her baton to her chest and dropped to her knees. Raimi stared at her in wonder and admiration. She herself often felt too terrified to go on, but she had never admitted it out loud.
Shh. Your shelf or mine, talking sophisticated topics all the time. Your shelf or mine, a kick back, relax, crack a book, unwind at your shelf.
Hello, and welcome to Your Shelf.
Or mine.
I'm Becky Standel, Youth Services Librarian at the Longview Public Library.
I'm Austin Brigden, Circulation Specialist here at the Longview Public Library.
Today, we are going to be talking about the work of author Kate DiCamillo.
Yeah. Is this our first author one of the year?
Yes.
All right.
So I selected Kate DiCamillo as one of our authors for this year, kind of because of Ann Patchett, I guess, who we'll be discussing later in the year. A couple of years ago, Ann Patchett published like a book of essays that was her pandemic book. It's called These Precious Days. And I adored that book. And one of the essays in that book was like a something that I think she had published before.
Yeah, in a magazine.
It was about Kate DiCamillo. And she talks about how she had met Kate at different functions before, because they're both successful authors. And she had been asked to introduce her at some sort of function, I think in Nashville where she lives. And she was like, sure. And she went and did it and like kind of hit it off. And she hadn't thought when she accepted the introductory role, she hadn't even thought of like reading one of her books first. And then after she met her, she was like, why didn't I think of that? Why didn't I do that? And so she ended up going home and getting all of the books. She owns a bookstore, so everything's pretty accessible to her. And then just sitting down and like reading a big stack of them like all at once. And she talked about how good they were, how like perfect that they were, and what a good time it was during the pandemic to be reading them. And it made me want to kind of just like sit down and read Kate DiCamillo's books. And then they have become like pretty close friends, and you can see in their like, they're both of their last books are like dedicated to each other, and they just have like a cute friendship for just some reader like me to observe from afar. So that's why I picked her. I had read Kate DiCamillo books before I read Because of Winn-Dixie and Flora and Ulysses, both for kids book clubs that I've coordinated.
I feel like she was a little bit brought back into the foreground of your attention when we went to see Ann Patchett speak. She came as part of a literary arts event down in Portland to promote Tom Lake, her latest novel. And she mentioned maybe a couple of times her friendship with Kate DiCamillo, and it came up because of the dedication. And she talked about them like, I don't know, I don't totally remember all of it, but that they had some kind of habit because they both get up early and work on their books. And Kate DiCamillo would like email her every morning and I think every evening and be like something about like heading into the forest, like, you know, like check in with her.
Mm-hmm. I've returned safely.
I have returned safely. Yeah. And it was very charming.
Yeah, I think if you're interested, Literary Arts recorded that.
Oh, yeah, it's been broadcast as a podcast. So yeah, I'm sure you can go to your podcast to purveyor and find it. Very charming woman, Ann Patchett. Sounds like Kate DiCamillo as well.
So I did what Ann suggested, and I checked out a stack of Kate DiCamillo books. For me, this last couple of months, I've also been deep in reading for the Evergreen Teen Book Award nominees final list. And so I've been working through a lot of that reading too. And so I wasn't quite able to do the like cozy in bed with six Kate DiCamillo books and read them all until like last night when I read two of them. So I didn't, as always, read as many things as I'd like. But I read, for this, I read Rami Nightingale and I read The Puppets of Spellhorst. I read the first Mercy Watson book, which is called Mercy Watson to the Rescue. And I had tried to listen to some audiobooks in the car. I did about half of Rami Nightingale as an audiobook, but then I just reread it as a book too. And I started listening to her newest book, Ferris, which just came out on March 5th. But I've been having a really hard time being able to listen to audiobooks lately. Like I can't stop my mind from going and just listen. So
and you have to watch that with audiobooks.
Yeah.
Your mind starts to wander and then you check back into the narrative and you're like, wait a second.
Yeah. So that was unsuccessful. But I am really excited about her new book as well, which is called Ferris.
I really like the idea of lately in particular. I think I'm always have a completist impulse, you know, where I want to read everything. But lately I've been feeling more attracted to that idea. I think because it reminds me of a way that I read, a sort of hungry way that I read when I was like a teenager and discovering different parts of literature where you'd hit upon something and you just feel like, oh my gosh, this is the thing. And then you'd seek out every scrap you could get from that writer. And I have been doing that recently with the novelist Rebecca Mackay, is just trying to like just read everything. Because I like that idea of going deep. You know, I kind of go wide a lot, you know, in our, which is wonderful in its own way. But going deep is cool, too. I had that experience of being in bed with a book. I got home and was feeling kind of crappy. And Becky just like stuck one of Kate DiCamillo's recent books in my hand. And I was just like, all right, I can't move. So I'll just read this. And it was really wonderful. And we both just read a profile of Kate DiCamillo in The New Yorker, and Becky was referring to Ann Patchett's, you know, recommendation of DiCamillo's work to people during the pandemic. And one of the things she says is that they're these sort of small, perfect, contained pieces that you can sort of sit down and read in a couple of hours and have a whole experience. And that's what happened with me and the Puppets of Spellhorst. So you talked a little bit about your background with Kate DiCamillo.
Yeah.
I have less. I read because of Winn-Dixie. I wanted to reread it for this, and I didn't. I only read a few pages, although in the profile, it brought some of it back to me. I remember, I don't remember that much about the book, The Girl and the Dog and stuff, but I remember it being a big deal when I read it. I mean, the book was a big deal, and I feel like a lot of the, whatever grade I was in, people really responded to it, and I did too. But it's probably been 20 some years ago that I read it. But when they're talking about it in that profile and they talked about the lozenges, the litmus lozenges that taste like sadness, I was like, oh, yeah. Anyway, that's all I have.
Let's start with The Puppets of Spellhorst. I'll also say there's been a few movies made from her books. They made a movie of Because of Winn-Dixie. And I believe that I saw that, but I don't remember.
And they made one of Despero.
And they made one. No, I did not see that. Just a couple of years ago, they made a Flora and Ulysses one for like Disney Plus. And we read that here with one of the kids' book clubs. It's about a squirrel. And so as part of their promotions for that movie, Disney like sponsored one of the squirrel bridges for a certain period of time.
Okay.
Which was cute. Any of the other ones been made into movies?
I think so. I think she's been pretty successful with adaptations.
Which is an option, I think, for the podcast challenge as well, is to watch one.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So anyways, Puppets. Why don't you start and tell us what it's about?
It's a slim book of what seems like it's going to be a new series from the subtitle. It's The Puppets of Spellhorst, a Nerendi tale. And I'm looking at the cover right now. Beautiful illustrations in this book. And it seems like she always has beautiful illustrations in her books.
Who illustrates this one?
Julie Morstad. Everything I've read has had illustrations. And it's Candlewick, which apparently is the publisher she's been loyal to all of these years. The dedication for Ann Patchett, who listened clear-eyed from beginning to end. It's a story about these puppets. A king, a wolf, a girl, a boy, and an owl. It's told in this, it's kind of spare, and in the way that fairy tales are spare, in the way of a story that's sort of been like polished down over time, you know, there's a little bit of that style or an allegory, you know, but it also has a fair amount of like her humor and stuff in it, and a sort of self-awareness about the narrative. It starts with this sort of sad old man who's a sailor, and he's like walking down the street and he sees these puppets hanging in this window, and he's very taken with the girl puppet who has these eyes that remind him of a woman he loved and let down. And he, you know, he seems like kind of a serious guy, but not given to buying puppets, but he like can't help himself and he goes in here. But the shopkeeper tells him that they come as a set. He must buy them all. And after some back and forth, he's like, fine. So he buys them all and he takes them back to, you know, the room in the boarding house or whatever. And he sets the girl up. I found that part very poignant. Mm-hmm. He sets the girl up and sort of like apologizes to her and then begins weeping. And he dies.
And then he goes to bed and he doesn't wake up.
Mm-hmm. And he writes a letter, maybe?
Yeah.
And then he goes to bed and he doesn't wake up.
Yeah, he puts the letter in the suitcase with the other five puppets.
And then it starts, that sort of is sets in motion his death. And these puppets sets in these puppets off on this journey. Mm-hmm. You know, they get sold. The innkeepers or the boarding house owners sell the set of puppets to the Rag and Bones man, you know, mm-hmm. who people don't know is sort of like a roving
thrift store,
you know, sells all kinds of things or little supplies people need. And then they're bought by a young man who takes them to a great house as a gift for his nieces.
The toy maker at the beginning says that the puppets are a set because they're going to be telling a story together.
That's right. That's very important.
Yeah.
That's very important. She does. So, it seems really simple, but then the more you mm-hmm. think about it, you're like, oh, there's so much going on. So in the course of this, so the puppets are cast out about on this journey of chance, and you're kind of like, what's going to happen? I'm afraid a little. There's like suspense. But you're also getting to know the particular personalities of these puppets, which are quite funny.
Yeah. So they speak to each other.
Yes. They cannot move, mm-hmm. which I thought was interesting. An interesting limitation that she puts on them is like, they can't move. So they're powerless to like escape or do anything. Mm-hmm. And they can only see things when they can see them, when they're facing a certain way.
If you've read The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane, which I've not read the whole thing of, but I've read about like half of it, it's very similar. They're still like, he's a toy. Like he never can sleep because his eyes are painted open.
She plays with the limitations and then also things that they remember from like when they're being made.
Yeah, or like phrases that they've learned. By the end, the girl knows three songs because that's how many songs have been sung with her around.
Yeah. And their little personalities, they start out kind of basic and they kind of grow mm-hmm. through their experiences. But like the wolf is always talking about how sharp his teeth are, her teeth are. And the boy is always like, ugh, I'm tired of hearing about her teeth. But it's like she just, oh, so teeth are so sharp. And and the owl only speaks in like little like riddles and koans and things because mm-hmm. owl is wise.
The king is very like, I am the king.
He's very conscious of like what a king should do.
And how people should be treating him, which is not really how people treat him. He's like, they should be doing what I say because I'm the king.
It was so funny. There's so much. And then poignant. Like it would be funny and then it would be so poignant. Like I found, you know, the wolf is kind of this ridiculous character for a while where you're like, ugh, roll your eyes, the wolf. And then the wolf talks about having this dream of running through mm-hmm. the snowy woods, and it's so moving. They're like a funny little ensemble cast.
There's this point in the book where the girl puppet has been like pocketed by the housekeeper, and the boy puppet's been like left out in the woods by one of the nieces. And then the wolf had been tossed outside because the housekeeper thought it was a squirrel skin.
It's really funny.
And she gets picked up by like a fox and taken to the fox den.
Yeah.
And the owl has also been picked up
oh my
by
gosh.
The housekeeper because she thought it was a
The owl gets, the order of things is all over the place, but like, so the two nieces, you meet these two nieces and they're very different. One is older and much more like wants to have the puppets put on a play. And then the younger girl's kind of mischievous and she decides that the wolf's teeth are really dangerous. And so she starts like pulling them out, which is a really like sad part. But then I don't remember, she like loses interest or gets distracted. And then that's when the maid thinks that it's a squirrel skin. At one point thinks the owl is like a duster
yeah.
and throws him to the bottom of her cleaning bucket.
Yeah.
Where he can like dimly hear what's going on.
And so the king is like on the mantle by himself because everyone else has been
taken. One by one.
And he comforts himself by being like, well, the puppet maker said that we would all tell a story together, so I know that they'll all come back.
Yeah. And so there's this slow kind of one by one. They're separated and they have little adventures of their own. And then once the older sister figures out what's happened, she sets about reuniting them for this play.
Which she has written.
Which she has written.
And they're going to be performing in front of...
Like a bunch of company.
Yeah, her parents' friends.
And the king, she like takes the crown off and he gets to be a wizard. And he's kind of like, I don't know about this. But he's like, a wizard! He's very status conscious.
Yes. And then there's like the play. So the story within the story.
Right.
Which is about, you know, the boy plays
a sailor
who leaves the girl he loves behind.
To prove himself.
To prove himself, to have adventures, and then finds himself cursed by a wizard that because he's abandoned the love,
yeah.
that when he steps foot on a solid ground again, he'll die of heartbreak. And then it turns out that story within the story is actually also the story... outside the story, perhaps.
So Emma, the older sister, like mm-hmm. finds the letter, obviously, that the sailor wrote and bases the story off of this letter. And it turns out that one of the women in the audience is the woman from the story. I mean, it's this whole nesting doll
yeah.
of narratives and stuff. And, you know, it's sad because the boy has to like prove himself. He thinks he has to prove himself so that like her family will accept him. But the girl already accepts him and tells him he doesn't have to prove anything. And so he loses the thing he loves. It's tragically senseless, you know. There's a lot going on. I liked it. I'm curious, like, what the next one, you know, where she's going to go with
yeah.
the series.
And then it ends with a housekeeper who has a very lovely singing voice.
Who is very weird.
Taking all of the puppets and leaving.
Right. And then the two girls grow up. And then what happens?
It says, do you remember the puppet? There's a coda. Do you remember the puppets, said Emma, one night when she was visiting Martha? Do you remember how we put on a show? The grown sisters were sitting together in front of the fireplace in the blue room. Of course, said Martha. There was a wolf and a king and a girl and a boy and an owl, said Emma. Yes, said Martha, and an owl. And then Jane Tweedham disappeared. That was the housekeeper. Said Emma, and the puppets disappeared too. The fire crackled and popped. It was raining outside. Wind beat against the windows. I like to think, said Emma, that Jane Tweedham took the puppets and traveled the world putting on shows. Wouldn't that be lovely? Yes, well, said Martha, I suppose anything is possible. Maybe I'll write a story about it, said Emma in a dreamy voice. Maybe I'll write about the puppets and Jane.
Which is a tee up maybe for the next book in the series.
Or that's just this book. I don't know.
Whoa, you're blowing my mind.
But yeah, Nesting Dolls. That's exactly right. It was really a fun book.
We also, she probably won't listen to this. We also like got it as a gift for a child we know.
Yeah, so, I don't think she listens to
that. I'm like, podcast. Oh no.
Her mother might. Yeah.
Spoilers for her Christmas presents, 2023. Yikes.
Yeah, so that one was very good.
I also read, so the two ones that I like finished were that one and then the Beatrice Prophecy, which I was aware of before because I think you read it.
Yeah, I read it a couple of years ago when it was new. So if you could just do a synopsis and that would refresh my memory of
sure. It's a bigger book, more of a full-throated novel, maybe a little older kid aimed. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it's also sort of magical feeling, mythical feeling. There's a girl named Beatrice, and it sort of opens up at a monastery where there's this brother Edic.
Yeah, it's a medieval setting.
Yes, yes. And, you know, these monks write down prophecies and words and things that come to them in these scrolls that are very important to the kingdom and stuff. And this girl turns up. Brother Edic finds her in the, like, stable with this goat. This goat who plagues the monks. This goat is amazing. This Answellica, this goat. The monks can't, like, get rid of her or butcher her because she's, like, too fierce. And she sends them flying through the air with her, like, headbutts. She's amazing. And so they find this girl all tattered and her hair's all matted. And she's sleeping in the stable with one. This is a habit she keeps through the book. One hand holding onto one of Answellica's ears. And Brother Edic is like, I don't know what to do. But he turns out to be a person who has a lot of courage, even though that goes very much against, like, his self-image. And you hear a lot from Brother Edic through the book. He hears the voice of his father telling him how terrible he is. And his eye, he has a crazy eye that swivels around uncontrollably. And his father sent him away to the monastery. And he doesn't think of himself as a brave person, but it turns out that he's the only one who's brave enough to help her. Because this is also in a situation, it turns out, where he finds out she can read and write, and girls are not supposed to read and write. And so simultaneous to this unfolding narrative is a narrative where you learn that the king of this area and his kind of weaselly counselor are looking, because there's a prophecy that a girl will unseat the king. And so they're looking for a girl who might be the fulfillment of this prophecy. And so there's a sense of danger. And they shave off all of Beatrice's hair and disguise her as a monk, not very convincingly. But then all the other brothers are really, like, scared to have her there. And people are killed and stuff. It's not, there's violence in the book, and there's, you know, a lot of loss. So people have been killed for much less. And so they're not real into the idea of having her there. And so eventually she gets sent into town. And I don't want to, like, get into all of the things you sort of realize as the book goes on. But, like, she goes kind of basically on this adventure. It starts out sort of like running away from danger. She doesn't remember who she is either, except her name. She's running away from danger, and she kind of assembles this cast of characters around her who help her. But eventually, over the course of the book, running away turns into sort of running toward a resolution, and sort of every character has an arc within that. And she, you know, relearns who she is and ends up, as the prophecy states, unseating the king, though maybe not the way you think she will, and making a great change in the way the society is. This is also a society, I should say, very, like, true to medieval, like, actual medieval, where, like, people don't read. Yeah. Like, just priests and monks and, like, royalty.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely, like, a book that, like, champions
literacy.
Literacy, yeah.
And stories and, you know, that Puppets book is, too. Like, yeah, yeah. It's definitely very into, like, the agency and catharsis might not be the right word, of, like, stories and of being able to write and being able to name things and tell your own version of your story. Mm-hmm. Great characters. I love Brother Edic. He's, like, always giving her these maple candies. One of the other brothers makes all these maple candies in the shapes of, like, leaves and fruits and little bewildered people is the phrase she uses. Little bewildered figures. And the goat is so great. And then she meets this boy, this very charming boy, Jack, who is very fast. He's an orphan. His parents were killed in the great woods, dark woods, and he runs. They tell him to run. He runs. And then this old woman takes him in. She dies not that long after, but then he becomes kind of the darling of the community. Nobody can read. And so he has a really good memory. And so he can memorize messages and run and give them. And he's really fast and he's really light. And so he's like the courier. And then eventually they meet this kind of like hippie dude out in the woods, who it turns out is like a former king who just like walked away from everything. And these five
Plus Dan Swilica.
Plus the goat, which happens much through the book. Like, people will say, the four of us, and Beatrice will be like, five. They, at first, are sort of trying to save Beatrice from danger, from getting killed by the king's soldiers who are looking for her. But eventually, because of her, she decides this. They're helping her, like, confront what's after her. I liked it. I told you at one point, I was like, oh, man, I feel like this could be, like, a Miyazaki film. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and he's adapted a number of, like, children's things. I could totally see him, I don't know, this monk and this goat and the guy who lives in a tree inside of the trunk of a tree. I could just, it has that, all the sort of fanciful elements. The boy and the girl and their chemistry, you know, with each other. And it has all the elements of, like, a Miyazaki film. It's weird, kind of.
She's also really good at writing, I think, animal characters that's not anthropomorphic exactly.
No, not really.
But that the way that, like, children, I think, especially see animals.
Right.
Where their personality comes through. You know, people will, like, ascribe things to them that, like, is maybe not so true. And you can, as a reader, see, like, both parts of it, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So they're very much, like, active characters in the stories that she's writing, but they're not, like, people.
No, and Anne Swellica obviously, like, has a real attachment to Beatrice. Kind of like a dog, you know, like, she guards her and everything. But, like, a lot of the personality of Anne Swellica is, like you said, stuff that's, is like, who she is to Beatrice in Beatrice's mind. And the things she might be saying in Beatrice's mind. Or, on the other side of it, who she is to the monks, which they're like, demon! You know?
Yeah.
The thing I've picked up so far from DiCamillo is it's like they seem simple on the surface. Or they seem, they're very, there's no wasted anything. It's, they're very economically built. But they have so much. The more you think about them, the more you're like, oh, wow. Oh, you know, that. There's a lot going on there.
To me, not that I've read even all of the books that he wrote for children, but she's always reminded me of E.B. White, or I guess always reminded me of Charlotte's Web.
Oh, sure. I could see that. The writing style.
Mm-hmm.
It's very like, Tony Early talks about that, like talks about E.B. White, you know, Jim the Boy, and those books where he was trying to get that style where it's like the writing is simple, but like not.
Right, and the books have, like, emotional depth and emotional honesty to them.
I think it's really hard to do.
And I think, like, a way of, and I think, like, as, I guess, the best children's authors do this, because we've talked about this similarly with, like, Judy Blume or Beverly Cleary, too, of, like, writing what it is like as a kid and what you see as a kid. And I'll probably, like, talk about that a little bit more when I talk about Rimmie Nightingale too. But like most of the kids that she's writing about are never in like great situations. They usually are like orphans or they only have one parent. Often that they're like, you know, suffered great loss or abuse or they're living in poverty. And it's not something that the kids themselves like recognize using any of those words. So before I talked about Rimmie Nightingale, though, I wanted to talk about Mercy Watson. Does Anne Swellica remind you of Paige?
I didn't think of Paige. When I see a physical goat, I think of Paige.
Paige is our doodle dog.
Because of the shape of her head. But no. But not like Anne Swellica's personality. But Mercy Watson, Becky had me read while she set up the podcast equipment. She was like, here, read this easy book. And it's the first Mercy Watson, and it... the pig at the center of it did really remind us of our doodle dog.
So in addition to writing these like
novels,
chapter books. Yeah. Kate DiCamillo has also written a few picture books and a number of like early chapter books or transitional books, I guess is a
early readers. Mm-hmm. We call them.
Yeah. So there is Mercy Watson and she's a pig. She lives on
Duckawoo Lane.
And so there's also other Duckawoo books about the characters who live on Duckawoo Lane. The New Yorker article compared the Duckawoo, or is it Duckawoo Drive?
I think it's Duckawoo Drive.
The Duckawoo Drive books to Winesburg, Ohio.
Sherwood Anderson.
Which I thought was a fun comparison.
Read it as a body.
As a body.
It sounds like she's just finished. She's just finished Mercy Watson, and this Puppets of Spellhorst is her moving into it. Yeah. They framed it that way anyway, starting a new series.
Yeah, the last Mercy Watson book, I feel like it might have just come out February.
Yeah, I don't know when that profile was,
but it
wasn't very long ago.
In the last few weeks for the library. Yes, and so it's like every character has their time to shine sometime in the series. But we're introduced to everybody in the first one, which is called Mercy Watson to the Rescue. And these are illustrated by Chris Van Dusen in full color. So Mercy Watson is a pig. She's like a full-sized regular pink pig. She lives with Mr. and Mrs. Watson indoors. She has her own bedroom and her own bed. And she really loves hot buttered toast.
She's treated like a kid.
Yes, she's like a child to them. And they think of her that way and they talk about her that way. But she's just a pig.
Yeah, they would object to that statement.
So at the beginning, it's bedtime, but Mercy doesn't want to sleep in her own bed. So she goes to sleep between Mr. and Mrs. Watson in their bed. And they're all having their wonderful dreams of hot buttered toast, or dreams that make them feel warm like hot buttered toast. And then for some reason, the bed starts to break through the ceiling.
The floor.
The floor of the
one pig too many
the house.
In the bed.
Mercy jumps from the bed and they're like, oh good, she's going to go get the fire department and save us.
Yeah, this is what reminded me of it's difficult to describe. Who could sum up Paige in a short moment? But she's so funny and kind of guileless, this pig, and she's kind of she's dreaming about hot buttered toast, and then she's like, they're like, oh no, what's happening? And at first Mrs. Watson's like, an earthquake, the end of the world. And Mr. Watson is like, nonsense, but he doesn't sound sure. And then she gets up. They're like, don't move. He's like, call the fire department. And she's like, how am I going to call the fire department if I can't move? And Mercy gets up and jumps off the bed, which makes it worse. And then in her head, we see her thoughts. She's like, I want some toast. But he's like, oh, she's going to get help. And then she goes down to the kitchen and looks for toast. Mm-hmm. There is no toast. And then she thinks, sugar cookies. And she knows that one of the neighbor ladies has sugar cookies.
Yes. Yeah. And then when she says, oh, baby Lincoln always has sugar cookies, you're thinking this is a baby. But it's not. It's an old lady, and her name is Baby.
Because she's the baby sister.
Yeah, of the Lincoln sisters.
These sisters are something else. Eugenia Lincoln, mm-hmm. the older sister, semi-villain.
Eugenia hates Mercy and thinks it's totally inappropriate to keep a pig in your house. And Baby always agrees because that's her role, is just to agree, even though secretly she likes Mercy.
Eugenia likes being right. Mm. They talk about that. That's the most important thing to her, is always being right.
So it's the middle of the night and Mercy goes over there and she taps her hoof on the window pane.
Uh-huh.
And
First she oinks.
Oh, yeah.
And then she snuffles. And then she taps on the window pane.
And that wakes Baby up, scares her, and she yells and wakes the other sister up.
She thinks there's a monster at her window. I'm not quite sure why she doesn't just see immediately that it's a pig.
Because they were sleeping.
It's clear to us.
And it's clear to Eugenia, too. That's that pig from next door. So Eugenia gets so mad at Mercy, she's going to, catch her.
First, she calls the fire department before she's even seen what's going on and says something I love. She has some line there is a crisis of uncertain nature at whatever their address is. And then she's like, come immediately. And then she goes and sees that it's the pig. She doesn't even see what's going on before she calls the fire department.
Oh, uh-huh.
She's like...
Oh, as soon as her sister calls for help, she calls the fire department.
She calls the fire department.
There's a crisis of an uncertain nature
yeah.
at 52 Decawoo Drive. Come immediately.
We all know Eugenia's, I think.
So she chases Mercy, because Mercy's just a sweet pig. She's like, fun, a game where I'm being chased. And so she runs.
Yeah. And the firemen arrive. Ned and Lorenzo. they're like, hey, look, a lady chasing a pig. They're kind of like, they have this moment that I liked where they're kind of like, is that the emergency? This job, man, you never know.
But as they're chell chasing this pig around the neighborhood, they hear the calls of help coming from the Watson's house. And they, of course, go to help them.
Save them.
Save them. And, of course, Mr. and Mrs. Watson are like, mercy, she did it. She called the fire department.
And then, you know, once they save him and the bed proceeds to fall all the way to the lower level, they're all outside and the firemen are like, all right, let's go. And, you know, Mrs. Watson's like, it's almost breakfast time. Do you boys like toast? And then there's this beautiful, I think it's a full page illustration of all of them, this whole motley crew, including the two sisters, including the Eugenia who's glowering at the table eating toast.
A lot of toast.
And you can see the illustrations are great. Uh-huh. You can see all the, because I was thinking, that's a lot of bread. There's all of these bread, loaves of bread.
On the counter.
On the counter all over, because they go through so much hot buttered toast. It's so funny, the origins of things, too, because in that, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The origins of things are so chancy. Like, you read that profile, and she talks about, like, oh, you know, she'd wanted to write these Mercy Watson books. Like, she bought a
page. She says in the...
Yeah, and then her... It wasn't until her friend was just going on and on about hot buttered toast one day that she's like, oh. Or in the profile, she talks about Winn-Dixie, the other book, where it was just, like, one night as she was falling asleep, she just got, a snatch of something. And you think, what if she didn't? Mm-hmm. Or what if she got a different snatch? We wouldn't have that
book. Or what if she got
the
snatch and just ignored it?
And I feel like that comes up a lot where, you know, when people talk about inspiration, it isn't so much like inspiration or that these people are more inspired than you or I, but that they're vigilant and putting these things to use.
Yeah. Her friend who inspired her with her love of toast is her co-writer on the Beacon Golly books.
I bet she could buy a lot of toast with the proceeds from that book. Yeah, I just thought that was cool. And also, like, a cool thing to remember for the people who have aspirations of doing something is that, like, you know, a certain amount of it is, like, a listening posture attuned to, like, the possibilities. And then they just come up in the weirdest places. She's, like, been wanting, did she say, like, 10 years she'd been thinking about writing these books.
Yeah, she'd been thinking about Mercy Watson. The pig.
For 10 years.
And then listening to her talk about toast, on and on about toast, she could see in her, like, mind's eye, Mercy Watson, like, nodding her head.
Yeah, and that's all it took. And now I don't even know how many books are in that series later. A lot.
I don't know either.
That seems kind of fun. It seems like it would be fun to write a series like that where you kind of just explore it over time. Like, oh, now I'll do a book that explores this, and I'll do a book that explores that.
And it's interesting, too, because there's, like, it's almost like two series. So, like, Mercy Watson is heavily illustrated, very short books like a reader. But the other Deca We Drive books are, like, really very short chapter books that are less illustrated. But they still have, like, you know, Mercy Watson's not so much the main character.
It's that world.
As the other, than the humans are the more of the main character. Which brings me to, I guess... Rami Nightingale?
Yeah.
So this is the first in a trilogy. I don't know if it's a trilogy. It's like a set of three like interconnected novels about these girls who are friends. Rami and Beverly and Louisiana. And
that's such a good name.
Definitely in Rami Nightingale, Beverly's like, what kind of a name is Louisiana? Is that even her real name? That's the name of a state. So Rami is the main character of the first book. And then there's a second one called Louisiana's Way Home. And then a third one called Beverly Right Here.
So they each get a book.
But they're all there from the beginning. So they live in Central Florida. And the book takes place only just within a couple of days, it feels like maybe a week. Rami's father has left her and her mother and run away with a dental hygienist. And so she comes up with a plan that she's going to run for Little Miss Central Florida Tire. And that when she wins, her picture will be in the paper and her father will see her picture in the paper because she's famous, and he'll have to come home. So she has, so her father has like a life insurance company, and the secretary at that company, she like helps her apply for this thing. And the first thing that she needs to do, her mother is pretty out of it through this book. She's just really depressed and doesn't feature so much in Raimi's life right now. So she signs up for a baton twirling class so that she can win this contest. And the other two girls are also signed up for the baton twirling class. They don't ever do very much baton twirling. But so she meets Louisiana, who faints on the first day. She is upset because she's had to give up her cat, Archie. And she's very, like, dramatic. She comes, she says, from a family of performers. She talks about her parents, the Flying Elefantes. Her last name is Elefante. And that they were trapeze artists who drowned on a boat, and their special luggage that said the Flying Elefantes also went down with the boat. We don't know in the first book if any of this stuff that she says is real or not. She lives with her grandmother in pretty dire poverty. Like, they live in a house where all of the utilities have been shut off because they can't pay the bills. And it seems like they pretty much exclusively eat canned tuna that they steal from the grocery store. But to Raimi, who's narrating this book, these are just facts. You know, she never, like...
She's neutral about
that. Yes, yes, exactly. And anyways, they her grandmother, who's a little bit off her marbles, maybe, had taken their cat into the... What did she, like, lie to her and called it, like, a very friendly animal, you know, something? Just, but to the pound, basically, because they can't afford to feed him anymore. So she wants to win the Little Miss Central Florida Tire 1975 competition, so she can get her cat back and so that they have money for food. And Raimi doesn't know that until like later in the book, and she kind of decides that it's like not super important after all for her to win. And she has this realization partway through the book that even if she did win, her father would never come back. The other girl is Beverly, and she can already twirl a baton. Her mother was like a pageant queen, and is, you learn, like physically abusive to her in a way that is also like Raimi notices, acknowledges, and has knows there's no judgment about it or anything like that. And she says that she's going to sabotage the Little Miss Central Florida Tire 1975 because she's tired of pageants and she hates them. And, so she also tells Raimi at this first day at baton twirling class that she's not afraid of anything. So that the next day when Raimi's filling out her application and she learns that she has to have good deeds to put on the application, and that secretary suggests that she go read to seniors at this nursing home. She gets frightened by one of the residents there and leaves her library book there. She thinks she needs to get Beverly to come get it back for her because Beverly wouldn't be afraid. And that's kind of how all three of them become friends. It's really good. It's a really small, like I said, like kind of like snapshot of her life. Other things that are really important to her is like the previous summer. So it's like the beginning of summer. It's like June 3rd, I think, when the book starts. The previous summer, she had taken a life-saving class with this, you know, like, lifeguard instructor. And I forget his name. And he had, like, this dummy that he'd throw in and they would, you know, learn how to rescue him and stuff. And I thought in this, it's very, like, first aid from the, you know, mid-1970s. It's not how we would do that kind of first aid now. But, and so the stuff that she learned in that class was, like, at the beginning of every class, he'd have them flex their toes and think about their intentions, you know, before they did their practice. And so she, throughout the book, is constantly, like, flexing her toes and thinking about her intentions. The instructor moves at the beginning of this summer to some other state, and she sees him like at the grocery store, and he like puts his hand on her head and then on her shoulder and says, "Goodbye, Raimi." And she talks about how, or she questions, why does it feel so good to have someone say that to her? Because her father left without saying goodbye.
Oh my gosh. Had you read these before?
No.
This is the first. So you haven't read the other two.
I started Louisiana's Way Home.
Mm. Wow.
Anyways, it's just full of like little things like that, but then also funny stuff happens.
Oh yeah. She seems really good at balancing like the different stuff, the bitter and the sweet. Wow. I feel like we have to say something about Winn-Dixie.
I wanted to say also about Beverly. She talks about how she knows all this stuff because her father's a cop, but he's like a cop in New York, so he's also not around. And when Raimi learns that, she's like, oh, you also don't have a dad that's here. But she says she learned all this stuff from her dad, like she can pick locks and break into places. And so they go to break into like the animal shelter, and they end up having like, this is like the climax of the book, this like midnight adventure where they're trying to do this, and all of these different kind of threads just come together at the end in a way that's really beautiful. So it's really good.
Yeah. No, it makes me want to just keep reading Kate DiCamillo. I feel like we should say something about Winn-Dixie, although I think feel like we both have not read it in so many years that it's limited.
Yeah.
But that's probably the title people are going to know, most likely know.
Uh-huh. Is that was her first book.
I watched some interviews with her, and we read this amazing profile in the New Yorker that I would recommend to anybody by Casey Sepp. That's really good, really powerful profile of her. It kind of talks about, you know, how she lives and where she comes from, and you kind of see how that informs her work. I was thinking when you were talking about the it being funny and also sad, I was thinking about those candies in Winn-Dixie, the litmus lozenges mm-hmm. that taste like sweet but also sorrow, because the man who created them was mourning his family.
It's like a little magical realism.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's what they said. Yeah, they said. It was like, it's a pretty straight novel as far as realism, except for these litmus lozenges. Fantastic. I'm really glad I got to read some Kate DiCamillo.
Yeah, I want to read, I mean, and because it doesn't take very long to finish these. Louisiana decides that the three of them are the three rancheros. And she's like, we just have to be friends now because we're the three rancheros. And the other two girls are like, what?
What? I started The Tale of Despero, which is really good too. I feel like Winn-Dixie is probably like the thing that people probably know, even now, probably know. People probably know of Despero, but they might know of it because of the movie. They were talking about how Kate DiCamillo has done so many things that have had such an impact, but people still might not know her name mm-hmm. in the same way as some. But she's had a big impact in children's literature and in the culture.
I think Despero was the one that won her first Newbery Medal.
I thought Winn-Dixie won a Newbery.
I think it won an honor.
Mm. So the two Newbery medals she has are just her wins, not her honors.
That's right.
Wow. She apparently, this is a big deal. She has two Newbery medals.
Yeah, it's pretty rare, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, she gets more.
She also seems to write very constantly and pretty fast. They were saying every year or two.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. There'll be like a novel, but then she's also doing shorter stuff too.
And that she has like that practice of writing pre-dawn
by candlelight,
2 pages every day
by candlelight,
pre-dawn.
I feel like you read that profile, her existence is very stylized, like her house, her existence. It's like,
yeah,
it's like a character out of a Kate DiCamillo novel.
Yeah, so because of when Dixie won a Newbery honor, The Tale of Despero won the Newbery medal. She also won like tons of other awards.
I feel like we haven't.
And then Flora and Ulysses won a Newbery medal as well.
I feel like we haven't talked about one thing that might be important to mention about her life too, is the sort of geography of it. I don't remember if she was originally from Minnesota before she went to Florida, but like.
No, they were from like Philadelphia.
Okay. I thought it was Pennsylvania.
And then she says like in that profile from the New Yorker, which is very sad too, I thought. She just had a very sad childhood. She says the first time her mother saved her life, she took her and her brother out of Pennsylvania and moved them down to Central Florida.
She was like a sickly child. She had pneumonia repeatedly, and so they moved to Florida for the climate. But like, even now you listen to her and there's like a southernness. Mm-hmm. But she's lived most of, you know, I think probably the majority of her life now in Minnesota.
Yeah. And then after when she was a young adult, she had a friend who's moved to Minnesota.
And she tagged along.
And she's like, well, I'll just come with you. It was after college, but she had always like kind of dreamed of going to the Iowa Writers Workshop, uh-huh. which she never did. But she's like, that's closer than we are here to that. So I'll go with you. And then she stayed there.
And then she wrote. When it's important to Winn-Dixie too, because she talks about in interviews and different things that she had been kind of mooning around, like saying she wanted to be a writer for like 10 years. She's like 30 at this point. She'd worked all these kind of odd jobs and stuff. And, you know, she'd kind of come of age in Florida, and they had like the worst winter on record in Minnesota, which she said is saying something, because it's Minnesota. It like got down to like, what did she calls it? Negative freezing, which is like negative 32, and she said it was horrendous, and it made her, and I've heard other writers, you know, being away from the place you're from, and it gave her this longing for Florida, you know, and so she sat down and started like kind of writing toward that longing, and that was because of Winn-Dixie. I just thought that was amazing.
Having just finished Rami Nightingale and then reading that profile of her, I see like the parts of all the three girls in that, where she talks about her childhood and the her father was a real abusive, and Louisiana also has swampy lungs.
Yeah, and in that profile, they kind of talk about, she talks about her stuff being emotionally true, even if it's, you know, fantastical, but also people around her talk about how, as the years have gone on, she's able to kind of get closer to,
like, autobiography. Yeah.
To the sort of, she's hitting certain things more head on, which if you know about her history, you're like, oh, you can kind of start to.
I also had read Betsy Bird, who's a librarian, and she writes book reviews and stuff for School Library Journal, had just like yesterday published a review of her newest book, Ferris. And in that review, she says she feels like a little bit about Kate DiCamillo, like how you might feel when you hear other people talk about a band that you really love and you feel like they're getting it wrong, like they're not understanding it right. And she says she feels that way sometimes when she'll read like other people's reviews of DiCamillo's books or talk about her as being like very like sentimental, and she's like, that's not what I see. And she's referred to that New Yorker profile, which is why I read that, but talks about how there's like a darkness in like a lot of her books,
yeah,
that a lot of reviews kind of, or reviewers kind of gloss over, or when they're thinking about her, they think of her books as just being very like maybe a little sweet and old-fashioned.
And there can be something old-fashioned about the presentation.
I would say maybe not old-fashioned, but almost like timeless.
Yeah. Well, thank you for nominating Kate DiCamillo for perhaps the greatest honor she's ever received, being featured on our library podcast. I was glad to read her stuff. Don't turn all this in quite yet, because I might read a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I want to finish Despero, because now I've started it.
Yeah,
I've really found it rewarding not coming from a children's literature place, except, you know, being like a former recovered child, to delve into some of that. You mm-hmm. know, I was thinking about having gotten to read now three, I think, Beverly Cleary, Judy Blume, and now Kate DiCamillo.
Yes, of the kind of the youngest.
I think about Dear Mr. Henshaw all the time, mm-hmm. all the time. I love that book. And so I welcome that.
We also did like Jason Reynolds, and he got,
oh yeah, Jason Reynolds. I read sort of like middle grade stuff of his.
Yeah, his is up and
but
up,
it's true
up and down like teen and young.
But
and younger.
But it's I've really enjoyed it. So next up on Your Shelf or Mine, we will be celebrating poetry,
mm-hmm.
and you know, because National Poetry Month is in April, as everyone knows. And that'll be a fun time.
We'll be talking about, I guess, whatever we want to talk about, but also looking at different kind of forms or ways that we can read poetry. I know in the reading challenge, we suggest you read like a collection of poems by one person, or a collection by multiple people, or a novel or a memoir that's been written in verse, or try listening to like a podcast where they read poems. So there's just lots of different options.
It's a varied world of poetry. So I'm curious to see what we come up with. And then I believe after that, we'll be back with another author or maybe a book club roundup.
And then after that is another book club roundup. Okay. And then another genre.
Yeah. So this year's different. We've talked about this. We're trying a lot of stuff. So, you know, if you're a listener, let us know what you think. Let us know what you enjoy, because we love to hear from you. And I think with that.
Thank you for listening to Your Shelf.
Or mine.
I'm Becky.
I'm Austin.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.
Support for Your Shelf or Mine comes from the Friends of the Longview Public Library, the Longview Library Foundation, and listeners like you. Your Shelf or Mine jingle is written and performed by Megan McHeldery from A Song for You. Find Megan online at reverbnation.com/Megan McHeldery. That's MEAGHANMCELDERRY. reverbnation.com/Megan McHeldery.
Ooh, that's good. What an opening.
I know.